Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Boker Tov. If I could remind people, please turn off the cell phones so that we don't have any musical accompaniment. It's nice to see everybody here. Thank you all for coming. If you remember, we are on the last part of a series of three. Just looking forward a couple of weeks from now. Next week, actually, unexpectedly, I'm not going to be able to be here. I believe that Rabbi Burton is speaking here next week. But 2 weeks from now, please God, we should go on. 2 weeks from now is nearly Tu Bishvat. The year moves on quickly. It's actually a leap year this year, as I'm sure people are aware. We'll talk about that later on. So 2 weeks from now, I'd like to deal with some halachic hashkafic issues related more to Tu Bishvat. We'll get there when we get there. But for now, we're in part three of a series, which is the last part, where we're dealing with the interplay between hashkafa and halacha. We looked in the first part at what is hashkafa, which I think is a useful conversation. We looked in the second part at is there a psak in hashkafa? And again, there's so much more to say about each of these topics. We're just uncovering the tip of the iceberg. And then we had a little break for egalitarian weddings, okay, last week. And this week we are getting to the third and last part, which is, I think, a fascinating issue, and we're going to be on a magical mystery tour around many exciting midrashim, which is, can you use midrash, agadata, as a source for halakha itself? Because we have an incredibly rich source of halakha. We have many sforim from which to draw. We have, of course, the Chumash itself, we have the Gemara, the Yerushalmi, the Bavli, but we have also very rich sources of agadata. The Chumash is not just halakha, but it's narrative. It has agadic sources within it. The Gemara is interspersed between the halacha, our series of midrashim. Can we draw on those midrashim for halacha, or is it really two completely hermetically separated systems, and never the twain shall meet? There's a parallel conversation, by the way, which I want to have nearer to Lag BaOmer, which is, what is the interplay between Kabbalah and halacha? Do we use Kabbalah as a source for halacha? And as we get more to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and Lag BaOmer, more Kabbalistic kind of vibes in the air, we'll talk about that, Be'ezrat Hashem, when we get there. But for now, let's look at Midrash. What is Midrash? Now, of course, technically speaking, Midrash could be halachic Midrash or agadic Midrash. We tend to use the word Midrashim in a shorthand colloquial way to mean, as in the Midrash says kind of Midrashim, which are, of course, the agadic Midrash. But there are entire Sfarim from Chazal, the Sifra, the Sifrei, the Mechilta, etc., which are halachic Drash, where rather than organizing the halacha in a systematic way like the Mishnah, which is by subject, they organize it by psukim, and they go through from Shemot, through Vayikra, Bamidbar, Devarim, and learning halachic drashot from the psukim. So that for sure, of course, is a source of halacha. That's not a question. My question today is on the agadic side, the agadata, the ones we call colloquially midrashim. And we started to talk about this in the first of this set of three, but I want to pick it up with starting with a source from Rav Aaron Feldman. Rav Aaron Feldman, the Rosh Shiva of Nezrel, Baltimore, wrote a very important book on the subject called The Juggler and the King. Quite an old book now. It was written maybe 30 years ago. It's definitely worth a read. And in his introduction there, he has an overview in which he writes, number one, as follows. The purview of a gadita, on the other hand, is the Jewish world of ideas. Primarily, it deals with the principles of faith, the philosophy, the ethical ideas of Judaism. In addition, it includes all those interpretations of biblical verses and stories which are unrelated to halacha expositions of the importance of mitzvahs, the rewards and punishments that they entail. Meaning, unrelated to halacha, he's at pains to say, agadata is not meant to be related to halacha. What is it? It's stories from the lives of the righteous, lessons in character training, and even sometimes what appears to be practical advice on worldly matters such as business, personal health, etc. And we all know the Gemara is full of agadatas. And we saw source number two previously, I'll just mention it once more now, which is that Chazal paints to say that Dorshei Haggadot Omrim, those who people are into Haggadot to say, Ritzoner Chagir et Misha Ama V'Haya Ha'olam, if you want to have a relationship with God, a meeting with God, an understanding of God, L'moid Haggadot, then learn Haggadot, that's what it's for. Shemitoch Kach Atamake et Misha Amar V'Haya Ha'olam U'medabek B'Dracha. Okay? The Dvekut. This area of connecting to and clinging to and sticking to God is part of what agadata is. And in a minute you'll see a whole page which you'll read on your own at some stage from Rav Heschel, which is going to deal with that more. Source number three, I think, is very beautiful. Shir HaShirim is a pasuk about the tapuchim. Rachduni b'tapuchim, says Shir HaShirim. Lay me down by the apple trees. Ki cholat ava ani, because I'm lovesick for God. Says Shir HaShirim Rabbah, Elu Hagadot, this being laid down by the apple trees, this is learning Agadata. Sheirecham v'taman k'tapuchim. Because the Agadatas have the reyach, they have the spirit, they have the tam, they have the taste. That's what Agadat is for. It's to give inspiration, to give spirit to mitzvot. It's vina rather than chochma. Source number five, kilo yavinu et pulat Hashem. The people who don't understand with vina, Rav Shua Amer, Elu Hagadot. These are the Hagadot. Therefore, understanding what Agadata is, source number four, I didn't look at it so much because we saw it previously, but it's worth looking at again, but I've given you on page two an entire page, an extract from Rav Avraham Yeshua Heschel's exposition on Agadata, which is absolutely beautiful. I'd love to be able to read it through with you now, but we don't need to spend 10 minutes reading this through in English. You can read it on your own. But on this whole page, Rav Heschel goes through and he compares halacha is this, agada is this. Maybe just let's pick a couple of extracts from this. Look at the beginning. Halacha represents the strength to shape one's life according to a fixed pattern. It's a form-giving force. Agada is the expression of man's ceaseless striving that often defines all limitations. Halacha is rationalization, schematization of living. It defines, it specifies, set measures, places life in exact systems. Agada leads with man's ineffable relations to God, etc. And you can read this, it's absolutely beautiful. About the two worlds. And one without the other is impossible. For example, in the middle, he says, about six paragraphs in, to maintain that the essence of Judaism consists exclusively of halacha is as erroneous as to maintain that the essence of Judaism consists exclusively of agada. The interrelationship of halacha and agada is the very heart of Judaism. Halacha without agada is dead. It's just rules. Agada without halacha is wild. It has no structure. It has no yira. And therefore, this is something that we need to give a lot of thought to and make sure that we have both of these, because sometimes societies within Judaism tend to veer one way or the other, and they tend to either be wild and lacking in any kind of yira and sense of red lines or boundaries, and everyone does their own thing. And other times they tend to be stultified and stuck within rules and details and lacking that kind of spirit. The answer is to have this interplay between halakha and agata. And I leave you to read this more on your own. It's a beautiful piece, and I think it was definitely worth bringing on the sheet. But what I really want to get into starts on page three, which is, okay, fine, we have these two worlds, halakha, agada. Can we blend? Can we use one as a source for the other? When the halakhic material, quote-unquote, lets us down, it doesn't give us what we need, can we go searching in the agadic material, or is that illegitimate? Let's start with a topic which we looked at very early on, but which I want to raise again, because there are many people here who weren't in those early shirim, which is surrogacy. Surrogacy is now something which is quite common. It used to be very rare. I remember there was a very famous case a couple of decades ago in London, where there was a young Jewish woman who had a surrogate child through a non-Jewish mother. So again, you have genetic material, you have ova from a Jewish woman, you have a womb which is rented, quote unquote, rent a womb for 9 months, or donated or given or chesed or all these things. You have a womb which is used for 9 months, which is a non-Jewish woman's womb, and then the babies are born from the mixture of those two things and handed over to the Jewish mother. Are these babies Jewish? Are they not Jewish? Do they have a Jewish mother or a non-Jewish mother? Which is the mother? Is the real mother the birth mother, or is the real mother the genetic conception mother, or is it maybe both? Two mothers, as if one wasn't enough, right? What is it if you have a Jewish mother and a non-Jewish mother? Are you Jewish? Are you half Jewish? Are you Jewish? Yeah? Well, how does that work? What about two mothers-in-law? That's not even work. I don't even want to go. I don't want to go anywhere even close for that. What, maybe this baby has no mother. Meaning, the Gemara doesn't directly discuss surrogacy, obviously, because surrogacy is a new question. Although, I refer you to the shiur that we had on surrogacy earlier in the day, when we did bring sources from the halakhic part of the Gemara. But there is a
an agadic suggestion. Look at number seven. Va'acha yalda bas v'tikra et shema Dina. And after she had a little girl, and she called her Dina. Now this, of course, is talking about Leah. Leah had six boys. Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun. Bilhah and Zilpah have had four. Gad, Asher, Dan, Naphtali. Okay? And there are two more tribes to go. And Rachel at the moment has had none. She has had no children yet. So now, after something, Leah has a little girl and she calls her Dina. Now that's a very strange thing, because first of all, after what? What came before that it has to say after? And also, she just called her Dina. That's a strange name to give a little girl. Justice. Meaning, if you're the Amish, the Pennsylvania Dutch, and your girls are all called chastity and charity and justice and, you know, and all that, I hear you call your little girl Dina. But why would Leah call her kid Dina? And second of all, every time Leah gives a name to a child, she gives a reason. Reuben has a reason, Shimon has a reason, Levi has a reason, you would have... Yeah, Dina is just out of nowhere. So the Gemara in Brachas says, why did something happen after? Amar Rav says, La'acha shidana leya din ba'atzmo. She made a din with herself, and she said, Ba'amra, Shneimasa shvatim atidim letzet miYaakov. Yaakov's going to have 12 tribes. Shisha yatsu mimeni. I've already had six. Arba min hashvachot. The maidservants Bilhah and Zilpah have already had four. Hari asara. That's 10 down. In zezachar, if my new child, which I'm now bearing, is going to be a boy, lo tehei achoti Rachel ka'achat hashvachot. Then my sister Rachel will only have one tribe, because I'm going to have seven. The maidservants have had four. There's only one left to go. And I don't want that to happen. That's not fair. Miyad immediately says this Gemara, Nefcha Labat. The little boy inside her, in Leah, she was praying again, turned into a girl. Shnei Mad, it says, V'tikrei Shema Dina. And then she had a girl. Okay. And of course, when the midwife said, Mazel Tov, you've had a baby, she says, is it a boy or is it a girl? It's a girl. Dina, that's what I wanted. Justice. I wanted the girl and I wanted my sister to have a boy. Now, can we use that source as a source in some way for surrogacy? What's going on in that source? I see some of you crinkling your noses up and saying, I don't like that. That doesn't feel like a boy turns into a girl turns into a boy. Sounds more like a transgender type discussion than a surrogacy type discussion. What does this even mean? How does this work midrashically? What changed? Did the neshamas change? Now, interestingly, the Targum Yonatan has a different version of that Midrash, which seems to go further to answer our question. Have a look in the Targum Yonatan in number 9. It's not entirely clear who wrote the Targum Yonatan on Chumash. The Gemara says the Targum Yonatan on Nach was written by Yonatan ben Uziel, and not necessarily the Targum Yonatan on Chumash. That's why sometimes it's called Pseudo-Jonathan, Pseudo-Yonatan, whatever. But it was written a very long time ago by someone from the time of Chazal. So look in number 9. Umin batar kedem, and after this says the Targum. This is on the psukim of Leah having Dina. Yilidat brat, she had a little brat. Now brat, I hate to tell you, is the word for a daughter in Aramaic. But I'm not going. That's why I'm quite sure of it. They decided to call it bat mitzvah, not brat mitzvah, because no, brat mitzvah would be parallel to bar mitzvah. But it just, you know, even though it's aphasite, it doesn't ring true. She had a little girl. Ukarat yat shma Dina. She called her Dina. Arum, why? Amrat, she said, Din hu min kadam Hashem. It's only fair from Hashem. Diyan min meni palgut shvataya. That I should have halved shvatim. Barom min machel. But from Rachel achoti, yat kuntre, my sister, Rachel should have two shvatim. Heich madanafku min kadam min amata. So it's just like the imahot, the shvachot had. Ushma min kadam Hashem saluted Leah. And God heard Leah's prayer. But look what it says here. And he switched the embryos. He took out the embryo from Leah's womb and implanted it in Rachel's womb, and vice versa. Yosef was placed in Rachel's womb, and Dina Bama the Leah, and Dina was placed in Leah's womb. Sounds far-fetched. Now, it doesn't sound far-fetched if you take it as a midrash, which is that presumably there's some deep, like Rav Feldman said, philosophy, principles of faith, ethical ideas. There's, I'm sure, very, very beautiful things going on with this midrash. But is it legitimate to use it as a halachic source? Now, this version of the Midrash sounds a little bit more like surrogacy than the Gemara, which is that they're actually transplanting embryos. And if you took this Gemara at face, or this Midrash at face value, it would, of course, seem to indicate that the birth mother is indeed the halachic mother, not the conception mother. Because if I ask 1,000 Jews walking up and down Keren HaYesod, who is Yosef's mother? They will say, Yosef's mother is Rachel. They will not say, well, it was originally Leah, and they won't say that. And if I ask who was Dina's mother, they'll say it was Leah, not originally Rachel. Although, it's not quite so straightforward, because there is another midrash that says that Shimon married Dina, okay, which is very problematic, because how could Shimon marry Dina? Because Shimon and Dina were full blood brothers and sisters. Unless, of course, you say that Dina was not really Shimon's sister, because Dina was really the daughter of Rachel, not Leah, and then you begin to answer. But is any of this really legitimate? Or is this just a little bit, as the lady over there said, farfetched, which sounds like a Yiddish word, but it's not really, okay? Is it too far-fetched? Or is it not just not what Midrash is for? Even though it's very interesting, it's very cool, and is this just not what Midrash is for? Are we abusing Midrash on a certain level by saying that? Although there are enormous halachic implications if we do use it. Another example might be from Esther, and we'll see this pasuk again in a minute. Look in number 10. Vayihi omen et hadassa. So Mordechai, it's not long till Purim now, Mordechai adopts Esther. Hadassah, he Esther, that is Esther, bat Dodo, who is his cousin. Ki ein la av ve'ein. She has no mother and father. V'hanarai pat to'ar v'tovat maresh, she was very beautiful. U'bemot avia ve'ima, when her mother and her father died, lakacha Mordechai lo lebat, he took her as a daughter. Now, the Gemara picks up on this in Megillah and says, Ki ein la av ve'ein. It said already, she has no mother, she has no father. So why does it go on to say, Ubermoit avia ve'ima, lamali, why do I need to know? And when her mother and father died. I know her mother and father died. You told me. You just said she has no mother and she has no father. This is tautologist. I don't need to say this again. So he says, no, this is telling you a very interesting thing. Meit avia, Ibrata, when she was conceived, Meitavia, her father died when she was conceived. Yaldata, when her mother was giving birth, Meita Ima, her mother died in childbirth. She was born to a woman who had already died. Rashi explains, Kashi Yaldata Ima, Meita Veloi Niret Likrot Ein, therefore you can't call her a mother. You can only call a mother someone who actually gave birth. Someone who was only pregnant with a child is not called a mother, says Rashi. That's why it says Esther had no mother. So again, do we say, oh, you see from here that bearing a child, being pregnant with a child, is not called a motherhood. Only giving birth to a child is called motherhood, in which case that might impact on our surrogacy question. Or do you say, no, just forget that. This is not relevant to our question. I need halachic sources. Don't bring me midrashim, because even though they're very important, this is not what they're for. We'll come back to that question a little bit later. Let me give you another situation, also from Esther, but completely different, which I think you'll find very fascinating. Let's take this same pasuk again, number 12. So he adopted her as a daughter. So I think you'll know, quite famous is this midrash from the Gemara Megillah. Tana Mishum Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir taught, Al Tikre Labat, Ella Labayat. It wasn't a daughter that he took her, it was as his household. He built his house through her, says the Marasha, Perush Le'isha. Mordechai, in fact, married Esther, who was his cousin. Nothing wrong with that. You can marry your cousin. I actually went to a wedding once of one of my students who married her cousin. My wife wasn't aware of this. She asked the grandmother, which side are you on? She said, both. Which was a bit awkward at the time, but it does happen. So quite so, Mordechai married his cousin. Does that give us any problem? Well, yes, a little bit. Look at the pasuk number 13, again quite well known. When I come to the king, says Esther, Hashelot kadat, and I'm not coming legitimately because the king has not called me. Kasher avadati, avadati. If I am lost, I will be lost. Now, on a sort of chat level, she's worried that the king's going to kill her because he didn't call her.
And if the king doesn't call you, you can't go and initiate with the king. However, the Chazal and the Midrash have a very different take. They say, look, since we've established midrashically that Mordechai and Esther are married, there's a problem. Number 14, the Gemara Megillah. Amar Rabbi Abba. Shalok kadat haya. What would it mean, shalok kadat? Not just on a pshat level that it wasn't kadat hamelech, that the melech hadn't called for her, but it wasn't kadat, it wasn't halachically legitimate. Shebechol yom v'yom ad achshav, every time she'd been called to the king until now, ba'oines, she had no choice. She was effectively raped. Because when a woman is called to the king, what choice does she have? It's not violent rape, but it's halachically, effectively the same thing. She has no choice. Which, by the way, in parentheses, is one of the approaches Chazal give to the whole story of David and Bathsheba. Because David and Bathsheba raises a problem. David and Bathsheba apparently had an affair, meaning she was married to Uriah Hitti. Okay? How then could he marry her afterwards when we know halachically that you're not allowed to marry somebody if there's been an extramarital affair between the two? And that, of course, was the origin of Shlomo HaMelech. This is a big problem. The Gemara gives two answers. One answer is that they weren't really married, her and Uriah Hitti. Why not? Because they gave a guest al-Tanai and they were divorced because he might never come back from war. But another answer the Gemara gives, which is the one that people don't necessarily quote, is this answer here, which is when David called for her to be brought to him, what choice does she have? She effectively is an anusa. She is effectively, quote-unquote, raped, not violently, God forbid, but halachically, because she can't say no. And, of course, an anusa is allowed then to marry the person that she was, God forbid, raped by, and that halakhically is permitted and would allow them to have a legitimate child. And that's another approach. But anyway, that's in parentheses. Here, we're dealing with Esther and Mordechai. Achshav b'ratzon. Now she's initiating. So, kasher avadati, avadati, says the Chazal, kashem she'avadati mi beit abba, kach oved mimech. Just like I lost my parents, I'm going to lose you. Because I can't be married to you anymore if I willingly commit adultery with another man, because we're married to each other. That's a kasher avarati avarati. Yes.
But married women weren't
searched
for and taken to the king.
Okay, but how do we know that they knew that she was married? Even if we say that she was married in real time on a pshat level, which it doesn't sound like she was, they would have kept it secret, possibly, etc. Or we'll get to Tosfos in a minute. We'll talk about that kind of question in a minute. You're asking a question on a midrash. The question we're going to get to is that a legitimate question? Because can you start asking kashas and questions and analysis on midrashic ideas, or is that whole approach just missing the point?
Well, that would invalidate them saying that anyone who we assume was married may not have been married.
Okay, so again, we'll get into whether you can or can't ask these kind of questions and whether that's legitimate or not. Interestingly enough, this whole question came up in a very interesting halacha l'maisa case in the 1700s. Look at number 15. The Nodiv Yehuda was asked the following shaila. Look at the story. Rikol makom guf din zeh sheyia mutzal eishet ish. Is it allowed, he asks, for a married woman liznot b'ratzon to voluntarily commit adultery kedei lahatzil nefashot, in order to save lives? That's what Esther did, right? According to the Midrash. She voluntarily committed adultery, according to Chazal, to save lives. He says, Einor Torah. It's not true. You can't learn that. The lo yashav einai masher ra'iti be'eze tshuva. And I don't agree with what you showed me, that some rabbi of a town gave the following tshuva. And this is the story. V'anashim v'anashim shehalchu b'derech. This is a real story that happened in Europe. There were a group of men and women who were on a journey. V'kam aleihem arki listim. The arch listim. Listim is a highwayman. I assume the archi listim is like the archduke and the archbishop, the king of all highwaymen. I don't think he was called Archie, but the archi listim. Archi listim is a guy you can't argue with. Echad besadeh, okay, im chaburat listim shekamoto, with a band of nasty, horrible highwaymen just like him. La roget kulam, and they were going to kill all of them, and they really were. The kama isha achat mehem, and one of the women decided to take her initiative. A isha yafat to'ar ma'od, very, very good looking woman.
And she started a conversation with the head bandit, Butvarim. She spoke to him, until she seduced him with her smooth speaking. And he desired her, and they went off to one side, and she made him promise, if I sleep with you, will you let us go? And he said, yes, I'm a man of my word. He said, take him as a man of his word. He's going to kill them, but he's a man of his word. And if she sleeps with him, he's going to let them go. And through that action, she actually saved her husband. In Kol HaNafashot, she saved all the people. They all got home alive. Upasak b'tshuva, and this rabbi of the town, Paskin and Tshuva Hahi, Sheshape Avda, she did a great thing. Umitzvah Rabba Avda. She did a great mitzvah. Okay? Sheshidalto Lazele Hitzlahafil Nafashot, she saved all those people. Raksha Al Kopanim Nesra El Bala, but she can't now be married to her husband. She has to divorce her husband. The Havi Raya Me Esther, and he brings a Raya from Esther. Beautiful. This midrash is now being used as a halachic proof that this woman did the right thing. She did a great mitzvah. She saved all his life, but she may not be now with her husband. Just like Esther was saying, I was going to be prohibited from Mordechai. The Ani Oimer says in Rabbi Yehuda, I want to say, Kevin Sheamra Chazal b'chol mitzrapim chutz me'avodah zarah gilui arayz b'shvichas damim. Chazal say you can save lives with anything other than the three big ones. You can't use gilui arayz, shvichas damim, murder, adultery, idolatry. In Cain, therefore he says, Kashem she'ei mitzrapim b'shalosh averas, since you can't use these three big ones, the cardinal sins, if you like, to heal people, kach ein matzili b'hel nefashas, you can't use them to save people either, to save lives. You cannot commit adultery to save lives. The einis derachman asharia, if a woman, God forbid, is forced into a relationship, be'isha shikarka oilami, that she can't do anything about it. It's against her will. Hainu shehi anusa al gupabia. That's when she's forced to actually have the relations. Aval hecha she'ein anusa. But when she isn't forced, al gupabia. The adarab, on the contrary, he mishtadelet lezeh. She is initiating. Lahatzil nefashot loy mikra karka oilam. That's not called being forced. The isha, the ish, shavim. And whether you're a man or a woman, teherek v'al tavor, she may not do this. She has to die rather than commit adultery. The Esther, but what about Esther? Shani, you can't bring a proof from Esther. Shehaita lehatzalat klal Yisrael. That was to save all the Jewish people. Mihodu akush, the whole empire. The ein lemeidim hatzalas yichidim mihatzalas klal Yisrael. You can't learn saving a few lives from saving all of Klal Yisrael. Minarva Avzakin, all from the youth, young to the old, the Adu Akush. V'sham Haya Ba'orat Mordechai, and also the Mordechai told her to do it, or based in the based in, or like Ruach HaKodesh. This woman didn't have Ruach HaKodesh, or a based in, or a Mordechai, and she wasn't saving Klal Yisrael, and therefore, God forbid, this should ever happen to any woman, she did the wrong thing. She did the wrong thing. Now, this is a fascinating case, which is debating the ins and outs of this midrash. It's all based on a midrash. It's not based on anything halachic. It's based on Esther and the idea that she was married to Mordechai. By the way, Rav Ari Schwartz, which some people may know Rav Ari Schwartz, he wrote a very interesting tshuva about 8-9 years ago on the following shaila. What happens if you have a married spy in the Mossad who is able to seduce someone in the Iranian nuclear program to give her the secrets of how to undermine the Iranian nuclear program and thereby save, who knows, Klal Yisrael in many different ways, God forbid it should ever be necessary, but is that allowed? Or, because according to the Nedeb Yehuda, she's not just saving a group of people on the road, she's now doing something which is relevant to the all of Klal Yisrael. Would this be allowed or would this not be allowed? And this was this sort of honey trap Shaila came up and it was debated in the papers, and I brought you a reference in the notes to the tshuva. You can read Rabbi Schwartz's tshuva and see what you think of it based on this midrash. But again, it's all based on the midrashim. You had a question? Well, it's not meant to be a factor, meaning saving one life, saving five lives, saving 10 lives, but once you get to Klal Yisrael, that's no longer quantity. Klal Yisrael is not just millions versus less than millions, it's Klal Yisrael. It's a qualitative difference rather than a quantitative one. I mean, this is what's going on here. Yes?
But the problem with that analysis is that you then have Esther standing in the face of Hashem.
Yes.
Because she is the one who saved Klal Yisrael.
Yes.
Because of Hashem, and she did it through this means.
Okay, and so, why is that a problem?
Well, because it negates Hashem's involvement.
Hashem sends people through people. Okay? That's what Mordechai tells her. Hashem will work something out through someone else, but your choice is whether you're going to be the one.
Well, if Hashem was going to work something out, she'd be done with
it. Okay, but then someone else could have done it. Let's go. Let's look at the main point here. I want to show you now in the next section, what do we say about this basic question? Do we or do we not learn from Agadita? And I want to actually refer you to a very good article by a close friend and colleague, Rabbi Emanuel Bernstein, who I know many of you know. He is renowned for his amazing Parsha Shirim, and anyone who has an opportunity to go to Rabbi Bernstein's Shirim, it's one not to miss. But he wrote an article on this in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society some years ago, and some of the material in the Shir is based on his article, and I referred you to that, and I suggest strongly that you read it. But let's have a look. Number 16, the Yerushalmi. I just need to go on for a little bit, but get back to some questions later. The Yerushalmi says as follows. Do we or do we not learn from Agadita? Here's the principle. Rabbi Zeira B'Shem Shmuel says the following. Ein Moirin, we may not paskin, Moirin, hurrah. Loimin ahalachot, not from halacha. Now this seems a bit strange. I mean, what would you paskin from if not from halacha? This is talking about halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai. If halachas come down as tradition, as a Kabbalah, as a Masorah from Sinai, they are, if you like, sui generis. They are exceptions. You can't use them in order to base systems of halacha on. You can't use that. The loimina agadot, you can't use agada. The loimina tosestot, you can't use tosesta either. It's a lesser form of halachic material. The tosesta was the material was left out of the Mishnah and later collected in a separate collection called the tosesta in the generations after Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Elamina Talmud, you've got to go to Talmud. You can't learn halacha from anywhere else than Talmud. Which, by the way, again in parentheses, was a big discussion in the 16th century, after the Shulchan Aruch was written. The Shulchan Aruch said, now you can paskin halacha from my book. And many people came along and said, no, you can't. You can't paskin halacha from a book. You can't pick a book off the shelf and say, this is the bottom line on halacha. Halacha can only be paskin from Talmud, meaning you have to have a holistic understanding of the back and forth of the Gemara discussion. That's the only way to get to a legitimate sect, not from shorthand summaries, not from outside books, and certainly not from Midrashim. And therefore, when the Tosfos asks apparently a halachic question, which is similar to yours in number 17 on Esther and Mordechai, the Im Taima, if you want to say, Amayloi Haya Megarsha, why didn't he just divorce her? Come on. How complicated is that? Get around the whole problem. He should say to Esther, okay Esther, listen, we're married, you need to go and sleep with the king. Here's a divorce. No, end of problem. And then we'll remarry afterwards. You can if she doesn't marry, so you can't remarry if she married someone else. But if she slept with someone else, maybe you can. I'm not getting into the whole discussion. He says explicitly he'd be able to remarry her afterwards. The Tosfos gives a strange answer. That you'd need Edim for the get. And he was scared. Penny is parasim. Hadavar la malchus. The king's going to hear. People are going to talk. The Edim are going to tell people down in the pub. Oh, you'll never guess who we just did a get for. And before you know, the king's going to fight. The Rashba goes against his Tosfos. He says, listen, first of all, you don't really need Edim for a get on a Torah level. He could have given the get himself without the Edim on a Torah. And he starts asking all these halachic questions on Tosfos halachic answer. But at the end, he says, underlined at the end of number 18, Ella, but actually the real answer is, Divrei Agada Hei. This is a Midrash. The Ein Meshivim Aleihem. You can't ask this kind of question. It's a halachic, you're asking halachic questions. You got the wrong guy. You got the wrong method, the wrong kind of source. You can't ask questions on an Agadita. And the Maharal explains in number 19, why not? Bishvil kach amru gam kein. This is why they said in the Yerushalmi, Ein lemeidim alach mitoch agada, ki lo nitzbarer. It's not clear. Agadita is not clear. Ki lo nitzbarer al yidei kushis utshuvas. You haven't got this back and forth analysis, questions and answers. She'az haya ra'u lilmod halacha mitoch agada. Only if you have an analytical process can you have a halachic conclusion. Halacha is very rational. Aval kaven sheloinit barer bibirur, since you're not really understanding the Agadita with that clarity, you can't possibly use it in order to reach halachic conclusions. When they said you can't learn from Agada, you can't ask questions on Agada, of course, it's a Dvar Chochma. It has wisdom. But the halacha is practical. He says a fascinating thing. Something which is halacha lemaisa has to be emet gamur. What does that mean? Emet gamur. Absolute truth. You have to have absolute clarity. But once you get into the realm of hashkafa, and this links to what we said last time, like midrash, it's not so clear. It's not so black and white. It's got some aspects of it like this, some aspects. There's a lot of grey in hashkafa. The hine Torah yesh lo kama panim. Torah has many faces. We call makom davashu hu halacha, but something who is halacha, which is halacha lemaisa, ain rak panim echad. There is only one face. And by the way, that is itself an entire series of shira of that one line, which is that true? Does halacha only have one real face? And everything else is wrong. There's one right answer and everything else is wrong. Because there are different ways, and now is not a time to get into that in great detail, of viewing halacha. When it says, Elu ve'elu, Dibrei Elokim Chaim, and the Gemara in Eruvin, Beit Hillel Beit Shammai, and they argue, and the Gebatkol says, look, you're right, and you're right, etc. Well, how do we view that? And there is one approach, the Ritva and others, that say, actually, there are multiple truths in halacha as well. There are legitimate multiple opinions. It's just that we paskin like one of them for the sake of unity, for the sake of clarity, but actually these are all coming from God on some level. There are other opinions, Rashi, and this Moshe Feinstein brings this in his Hagdamah to the Igros Moshe, that says, no. There actually is one correct answer in Halacha. Elu ve'elu, this is what Maral says, Elu ve'elu dibrei Elokim Chaim doesn't mean that you're right and you're right. It means you say what you say, you say what you say, and there's legitimacy in the argument. But actually only one of you is right. And there's only one right answer. And Rav Moshe, it's very worthwhile reading the Hagdamah of Rav Moshe's Igros Moshe. He writes there, he says, first of all, why am I writing tshuvas for Klal Yisrael? He says, I didn't appoint myself as the Godel Hador. People started asking me questions. I started writing answers. People liked them. More people asked questions. I wrote more answers. And before you looked around, everyone in Klal Yisrael is sending me questions. So first of all, it's a grassroots thing. Second of all, he says, who am I to give you an answer? Maybe I got it wrong. Maybe in Shamayim they're screaming, Moshe, you got it wrong. That's not the right answer. How can you? And he says, because there is one right answer in Halacha, like the Maral says, and all the others are wrong. He says, at the end of the day, if we do what we can to get it right, even if we got it wrong, we got it right. Which is that if we got it wrong in Shamayim, at least we got it right in that we went through the halachic process itself. And that itself, a schut, the Ran talks about this as well, that you get more schar for the effort than you get for actually getting the right answer. This is a much bigger share in and of itself, but I just wanted to alert you that this line in the Maharal where he says there's one answer in halacha is itself a very big discussion. But in Hashkafa, anyway, he says there are multiple answers. Lekach, I'm on the end of the sixth line, Lekach ama she'ein magshin usholim b'divrei Agadah. That's why they said, you can't learn from Agadah. It's too complex, it's too grey, it's too unclear what's going on. You can't learn halacha, and this was a very mainstream approach. I brought you two more, Tosfos Yontif in number 20, Ach Asa Shavti, he gives the psak here, and then he goes back. It says, V'ra'iti she'ein lemeidim halacha mi midrash rabba. So you can't learn halacha from midrash rabba. More about that in a minute. So too the note of Yehuda at the end of his whole exposition on Esther, and the arch highwayman, he concludes, he says, number 21, Hamidrashim, the Ha'agadot, Ikar Kavanatam al Hamusa. Agadata and Midrash is there for Musa, for ethics. V'ala Ramazim, it gives hints. V'ala Mashalim, it gives parables. Shebahem Hakol Ikahadat. They are fundamental to religion. I don't belittle them at all. Aval Ein Ikah Kavanatam al Piskei Haloch. But it's not meant to be V'alocha. Lachain, therefore, he says, Ein Lemedi Mehem Lissak Halacha Klal. And at the end of the day, I think the Tosfos Yontif is right. We can't learn from Agadah. And he throws out the whole Midrash with Esther and Mordechai, etc. Yes? From Kimchis? That's not where we learn the halacha of women covering their hair. That may be where they learn the chumrah of covering your hair inside the house,
But that is not clear whether that's the halacha. But you will see there are many exceptions to this. We'll see. Let's go on. I want to show you the exceptions, and then you'll be able to see whether it fits the question that you're about to ask. We seem to have a principle, therefore. You can't learn from halacha, from a gadita. But as the lady in the back saying, but don't we? You can start thinking now amongst yourself of, are there any halachas that we learn actually from a gadic material? And if you start thinking through, you'll begin to think, ooh, what about this? What about that? And what about this? And it seems now that like all good rules, there are exceptions. Have a look at number 22. Comes along the Rabbi Kiva Eger. And he quotes these principles. Everybody says you can't learn from a gadita, you can't learn from Midrash. Eila meidim halacha mi-Midrash rabbas. He quotes here the Tosfos Yontif. And he says, number 22, Ha-Pri-Chadosh, he quotes the Pri-Chadosh, V'Sefer Mayim Chayim, he disagrees with this. Da-Hach-Klala, Rakla, Inyam, Psak-Halacha, Kedivri, Mi, this rule that you can't learn from Midrash only applies to, let's work out who to paskin like, this side or that side. Hecha D'Loy Mufurish B'Shas V'Ha-Hilkata, when the Gemara talks about an issue, but it's just not clear which way we paskin. You can't start reaching out to Gemara, to Midrashim, and bringing proofs from there. Meaning the Gemara talks... Are people cold? No, yes? Okay, we'll give that, and we'll take that as a no, because but if people are not cold, people are going to be hot, okay? So you can't start reaching out to Midrash when it's just a question of who we paskin like. Aval, and here's your first exception. Dina deloy it parish b'shas. A halacha that doesn't even appear in the Shas. What about something that doesn't appear anywhere in Shas? Matsinu kama pamim v'lemeidim imidrashas. Then we do. Meaning the Gemara doesn't talk about everything. If you can find me an area, says Rabbi Kiva Eger, that the Gemara doesn't talk about at all, okay, then the Midrash is fertile ground for halachic sack. And actually Rabbi Vadi Yosef says the same thing. Look what he says. He says, number 23, Ibra Amrina B'Yerushalmi. I agree. Nonetheless, we say in the Yerushalmi, Eila Meidim Loi Min HaGadus. You can't learn from HaGadita. And then he quotes the people we've seen. The Knesset Gedola Kosov, the Chiddush HaRashba, the Megillah, that was the Rashba on the Tosfos. The Tosfos Yontif says that, the same thing. Achen Kvar Alu B'Zeh Achronim. Indeed, this has been discussed in the Achronim. The Loi Amrinan Hachi Eila Kashiyei Shtir and the Zed Min Hashav. We only say this rule that you can't learn from Midrash when it contradicts the Gemara, says Rav Avadia. The Loi Katosfos Yontif. I want to follow the pre-chadish. Demi, and I underline this. Me, demi yochel lachloit al hamidrash beloy raya me'ashas. Okay, you can argue on the midrash from the midrash if you like, but if there's no problem from the Gemara itself, the midrash may be authoritative. The kenkos of the sefer ma'im chaim, etc. And then he brings at the end, sheyesh lilmol mina midrashim kasheinu machishim et haTalmud. You can learn from the midrash when it doesn't contradict the Gemara. Sheharbe minhagim biyadenu al pihem. How many minhagim come from midrash? So how many minhagim? This is interesting. Do we have minhagim that come from midrash? Yes, we do. Let me give you two examples. We have a minhag that we blow the shofar every day during Elul. That's not a halacha. It's a minhag. Okay, the halacha is you blow on Rosh Hashanah. Why do we blow the shofar during Elul? It's based on the midrash that when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Har Sinai on Rosh Chodesh Elul to get the Torah for the second time, they blew the shofar, says the midrash. So because the midrash says that when Moshe went up in Elul to blow, to collect the Torah, they blew the shofar, so we blow the shofar. Very nice. I give you another minhag. We don't say Baruch Shem Kavod Matasol Yolam Va'ed out loud. Why not? Why do we whisper it? We don't usually whisper our tefillahs. Anyone know? Because the Midrash says that Moshe Rabbeinu went into Shamayim and heard the Malachim screaming, Baruch Shem, Kavod, Machatoli, Olam, Va'ed. And he took it and said, that's a great tefillah, brought it down to earth. But when we say it, we don't want the Malachim to hear that we know that they say it. So we whisper it, because otherwise it would be inappropriate for, you know, so that we stole it from the Malachim. Except on Yom Kippur, when we ourselves are like Malachim, and therefore what are we scared of? So we say it out loud. Beautiful. It's all based on Midrash, but it's a minhag. Says Rav Avadia, that's legit. We get minhagim based on Midrash, and there are exceptions to this rule that you can't learn from Midrash. I'll give you another idea. The Shvus Yaakov, look at number 24. The Shvus Yaakov, let's go a little bit quicker through this. Shvus Yaakov says, "V'halo ein lemeidim halacha min divrei agada, haynu dafka hechashu neged asvara."
That's if it goes against logic. Or a sugya, or against the sugya in Shas. What does it mean it goes against logic? A question was asked by the Shvus Yaakov, what happens if, God forbid, somebody kills another person unintentionally? Are they called a rosha? Or are they not called a rosha? God forbid somebody's driving a car, they were texting on their phone, or they weren't looking where they were going, or whatever it is, and they got into a car crash, and God forbid someone gets killed. Is that person called a rosha? They didn't kill intentionally, but they killed somebody. So the Shvus Yaakov says, I'll bring you a medrash. Here's a medrash number 25. Again, quite well known. The Shmuel Aleph says, Kasha Yomim Mashal Hakadmoni. There is an ancient saying that says, Mirushaim Yetzer Resha. From wicked people, wickedness comes. Says the Gemara. What does that mean? What are we talking about? But Shnei Bnei Adam, there are two people, Shehargu Et HaNefesh, who killed Echad Harag B'Shogi, one killed accidentally, Ve'echad Harag B'Mezid, and one killed intentionally. Lezeh Ein Edim, Ulezeh Ein Edim. To this one, there are no Edim, and to this one has no Edim. No one can take them to court. Of course, the one who killed intentionally deserves himself to be executed, according to the halacha originally, and the one who killed unintentionally deserves what? To be sent to the Irim Miklat. He gets sent to the Irim Miklat. Says the Gemara, what do we do in this case where there are no Edim? HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mazminim Lepundak Echad. Hashem takes them, eventually, by serendipity, to the same inn. Zeh Shaharuk B'meizid Yoshev Tachat Asulam. The guy that killed on purpose happens to be sitting under a ladder. Zeh Shaharuk B'shoigeg, and the one who killed by accident, Yoyred B'sulam, is coming down the ladder. The Nafal Alav, he falls off the ladder, the Hargo, and he lands on top of the guy who was the intentional killer, and he kills him. Zeh Shaharuk B'meizid Nerag, so the one who killed originally, intentionally, gets what he deserves, and he gets killed. Zeh Shaharuk B'shoigeg, and the one who killed unintentionally, Gola, he gets sent to an Irim Miklat. So Hashem works it all out in the end. Says the Shvus Yaakov, you see from here, from a midrash, that someone who kills unintentionally is a rasha. And he says, but I reject that. Because it's not a svara. It goes against svara. It goes against logic that someone who killed unintentionally should be called a rasha. A rasha is someone who does things on purpose. This person was negligent. He acted highly inappropriately. But he's not a rasha. And therefore he rejects this midrashic idea on the basis that he thinks it goes against Svara. But that's difficult, because what's the Svara? You know, how does Svara work? Svara could go one way, it could go another way. I'll give you another example. The Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch itself in Halacha says, number 26, Hamagbir Yado al Chaver, this is last week's Parsha. If you raise your hand to hit someone, La'akosai, but you don't hit them, you just raise your hand to hit them, that itself disqualifies you from giving testimony. If you're the kind of person that raises your hand in anger but you never actually hit them, you're a rasha. You can't give testimony. Where does that come from? Where does that come from? Moshe Rabbeinu and the mitzri, or actually the two Jews. The two Jews. It comes from, the smart brings down, it comes from a medrash. The Moshe Rabbeinu says to the Jew, Rosha, lama takera echa, why are you about to hit your friend? He didn't say, why have you hit your friend? Why are you about to hit your friend? Says the Midrash, you see that someone who is about to hit someone else is called a Rosha. But this is a Midrash. This is not a halachic source. And yet the Shulchan Aruch brings this down the halacha that this is a legitimate halachic source. Says the Shvus Yaakov, yeah, because that makes more sense than this. Someone who gets angry and fits to hit someone is more of a rasha, out logic, than somebody who, God forbid, you know, drives his car accidentally into somebody else and kills them. I don't know. You could use the logic the other way. You could say at the end of the day, the guy who hit his fist didn't actually hit anybody. That's less bad. And the guy who actually killed someone unintentionally actually did kill someone. So once you get into the realm of svara, you know, your svara, my svara, it's like pshat and drash, you know? The Hamalevites used to say, what's the difference between pshat and drash? What I say is pshat, what you say is drash. You know, like my svara is a good svara, your svara is a boy's svara. You know, it's very hard to work that out. There is another approach, and this I think you'll find really interesting, which is the Rosh brings, which says, okay, you know something? There is a rule that you can't pass from midrash. But that's only midrashim which are not in the Gemara. Because when they edited the Gemara, when Rav Ashi and his team edited the Gemara, they chose to put certain midrashim in the Gemara itself. Maybe those midrashim have a higher level of authority than the ones that didn't make it into the Gemara. That's an interesting question. Let's test that analysis. Number 28. The king Mochiach Vesoita says the Rosh, I'll bring you a case. Da'amalei Yosef Leparo. Again, a couple of weeks ago in the Parsha. Yosef says to Paro, Avi Hishbiani. What's happening here? Again, a midrashic idea. Yosef goes to Paro and says, I need to bury my father in Eretz Yisrael. Paro says to him, why bury him in Egypt? Yosef says, he made me swear. I made a shavua. So what? If you make a shavua and you need to get out of having made the shavua, what can you do? Atas Adarim. The Amalei, so he said to Paro, Zil Itchil Ashvuatech. Go and ask a rabbi and get your shavua removed. Meaning Paro, the Talmud Chacham. Don't bring me shavuas. You can go and do Ataras Nadarim. Says the Rosh, Alma, you see from this midrash, Hayayochel Ahatish Shaloi Bifnei Yaakov, that even though Yaakov was dead, he was still able to do Ataras Nadarim on a shavua. What's the halachic shaila here? If someone makes you make a shavua, and that person's no longer alive, is it still possible to do Hataras Nadarim on that Shavua? That's a halachic question. He brings from a midrash, yes. You see, from the fact that Paro asked Yosef to do Hataras Nadarim, even though Yaakov wasn't alive anymore, it worked. Says the Rosh, ah, but you're going to all scream at me. You can't learn halacha from a midrash. Says, v'ilav hilchaseh, if this wasn't halacha, loy hava kava leiba hashas. It would never have made it into the shas. Which is very interesting, because we see our ironclad principle that you can't learn halacha from midrash is beginning to crumble a little bit. Because now we have halachas that are in shas, apparently learned from midrash. Look at number 29. 29 is one of the most wild midrashim. You end up with a discussion here in the Rabba Bar Bar Chana stories. In Bava Basra, you have some very unusual things going on with Rabba Bar Bar Chana. Have a look in number 29. Rabbi Yochanan Mishnah. Rabbi Yochanan relates the following. Now see what you make of this. Zimna chada, once it happened, have kazina besvinta, we were on a ship, the chazin and hahi katlita, we saw a chest, dehavu mekabai by avanim toivet umar goliath. We saw in the sea a chest which was laid with beautiful stones and pearls. The hadra lay mini kavri, and they were swimming around it all sorts of fish, demikri karsha, which are called sharks. Okay, there are sharks swimming around this chest in the sea. Nachit bar amurai, a diver went down, la'atya, to go and bring it up. Viragish, the sharks got angry. Uboy l'shamte la'atme, and they tried to bite his legs. Vashada zika zachala, he threw in a flask of vinegar. Vanachat, and they left him alone. Nachat batkala, a baskal came out, this is in Gemara in Bava Basra, a baskal came out of Amalem and said to them, leave this chest alone, what are you doing with this chest? My Yitzchuk, what right do you have to take the katlita, the debitu de Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa? This is the chest of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, and she is a very famous woman, the wife of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, sorry, the atida l'shadiye, and what's she going to put in this chest one day? Techilta, the tchelet, of the tzaddiki la'alma da'asi in the world to come. What on earth is going on? What on earth is going on? There's a ship and there's a chest with precious stones and there are sharks and there's a diver trying to get the chest and the sharks get pushed away with a thing of vinegar. And look, I'm assuming that there's every single part of this midrash is deeply symbolic. Everything is a deep ethical, philosophical, hashkafic, maybe Kabbalistic idea. And this chest is a chest that Rabbi Zachanina ben Dosa's wife one day will put the tchelet in. Comes along the Rosh and says, you see from this midrash that women are allowed to make tzitzis. Of all the things that I was expecting to learn from this midrash, that was not the one. Because women are not allowed to write a sefer Torah, to make tefillin, the Rosh says, because they are, there's a connection between tefillin and sefer Torah, they're not commanded in sefer Torah, because the Talmud Torah, different mitzvahs, etc. But tzitzis, you might have thought, that since women are not obligated in tzitzis, So women are not valid to make tzitzis. So you see from here, the Rav Chanina ben Dosa's wife, she's the tzitzis maker of all types. Now again, the Rosh is living up to his principle, which is, if this hadn't been in Shas, maybe he would have said, oh, you can't learn from a Midrash. But since it is in Shas, he does learn from this Midrash, which is very interesting. And not just a Midrash, but a very Midrashic Midrash. Let me give you another example. I have a student, let's say, tells me, my parents won't let me come to seminary, yeshiva. They don't want me to come to yeshiva. They want me to stay at home, go to university, get a job. How do I know whether I'm allowed, because of kibbutz av ha'em, to go against their wishes? Now, of course, the parents don't have to pay. That's another thing. So the parents say, we don't want you to go to sem. To yeshiva. So how do I know if going to yeshiva overrides Talmud Torah? Says the Shulchan Aruch 31, Talmud Torah godol mikibbutz av ha'em. Talmud Torah overrides kibbutz av ha'em. Interesting. Where do they get that from? How do we know that Talmud Torah overrides kibbutz av ha'em? Look at number 32. Gemara in Megillah. Okay, I'm a Rav Yitzchak Bar Shmuel Bar Marta. Godol Talmud Torah yotzei mikibbutz av ha'em. Talmud Torah is greater than kibbutz av ha'em. Shekol oisam shanim shehaya Yaakov Avinu beveis eva loinenash. Again, a famous midrash. Yaakov Avinu was away from his father Yitzchak for many years, and keneged those years, corresponding to those years, he himself was punished. His son Yosef was away from him. But the years that Yaakov spent in the yeshiva of Shem Va'eva do not get counted in that, and he doesn't get punished by having Yosef away for those extra years. Why do we need to see the life of Yishmael? Who cares how long Yishmael lived? And Rashi brings this down on the Chumash. We need Yishmael to kalkia Yaakov's years, and Shmamina, Arba'es, Rishanim, the 14 years that have a base Eva, Loi Chashiv Lehu, are not counted. Again, a very overtly Midrashic source, which translates into a very clear halachic concept, which is, you're allowed to go to yeshiva, even if your parents don't want you to go to yeshiva. Again, who pays for the yeshiva is a different question. But you see here many examples of midrashim which are leading to halachas. And we're going to have to fit these rules in. Because again, you'll find that some people say you can never learn from midrash. Some people say you can learn if it's not against the shas. Other people will say you can learn if it's in the shas rather than a midrash rabbah. And I just want to finish with two things. Number one, the stakes in this conversation are high. Because one of the most famous midrashic ideas that people know about is the Gemara at the end of Ksuvah. That Hashem, based on Shir HaShirim, made the Jewish people take oaths, the Shalosh Shavuos. One oath, look at number 35. It's based on the Pesukim, Hishvati Etchem Benot Yerushalayim. Rabbi Zeira says, the Rabbi Zeira says, Ahu Mizoyle Ked Rabbi Yosef Reb Cheni. We need these Pesukim that say God promises, the Jewish people have to promise, they will not arouse God's love before its time. Gimel Shavuos Halal Ulama. Why do I need three Shavuos? What are these three Shavuos? Achat Shelo Yala Yisrael Bachoima. One that Yisrael will not go over the wall, or Kachoima, or like a wall. Rashi says, they won't go back to Eretz Yisrael. Yachad B'yad Chazaka. They won't take Eretz Yisrael by force. The Achat Shehishpi HaKadosh Baruch Hu Et Yisrael Shelo Yimrdu Ba'umat Olam. That the Jews won't rebel against the non-Jews in Golas. The Achad and one oath, Shehishbi HaKadosh Baruch Hu, et Oivdei Kochavim, that he made the non-Jews swear, Shaloi Yishtabdu B'lebahem Yisrael Yotamidah, that they won't oppress the Jews in exile more than necessary, whatever necessary is. Now, very famously comes along the Sabarov, Flasit Tavit Hakam, the Vayol Moshe, and says, it's awesome to have a state in Israel, because clearly there are Shalosh Shavuos, there are three oaths, they appear in the Gemara. Ah, they're Midrashic, but haven't we already said you can learn halacha maybe from Midrash that appears in the Gemara? Three clear oaths that say we're not meant to be taking Israel by force. We're not meant to be rebelling against the non-Jewish world. Now, you know, the stakes are high with this discussion because, you know, we're coming up to another election. All of these issues are going to come out. I was in America a few weeks ago. I had a discussion at the Shabbos table with somebody who seemed to be a very, you know, normal, rational, reasonable kind of guy. And I said to him, you know, do you feel that young people in America are more likely to be making Aliyah now than 5 years ago? And he suddenly erupts into a no, because it's Osir to live in Israel, because of the three oaths, and this and that, and he really got very excited at the Shabbos table. I didn't mean to ignite him in that way, but he's really giving me the three oaths, and the question is that legitimate? Can we really take these three oaths and say, maybe Taka, we shouldn't have a state of Israel? Or do we turn around, and I've given you many responses on page 8, and say, no, they're midrashic. You can't learn from midrashim. They're not. They don't appear in the halacha. They don't appear in the Shulchan Aruch. They don't appear in the Rambam. Maybe they mean something else, which is metaphorical. Other people say no, because the non-Jews broke their side of the bargain. They did oppress us more than necessary, clearly. And therefore, we're not held by those oaths. Other people say that we didn't take Eretz Israel by force. We took Eretz Israel because the non-Jews gave Eretz Israel. This was the Meshech Chochmah talks about this at the San Remo conference, the UN partition plan. But then you get into a whole discussion about Yehuda the Shomron and the Six-Day War. Is this whole discussion even relevant, or do we just dismiss it and say, we're not learning halacha from Midrash, go and find some other source. This is not relevant. And so you see, this is not just a theoretical question, this is a practical question. I just wanted to bring you one last idea to finish with, and you can look at 38 to 41 on your own. There is a strong stream of thought within the Meforshim, which is, since Midrashim are so complex, are so important, are so nuanced, you are not allowed to teach them to children, and you are not allowed to teach them to Amei Haaretz, because they will just get the wrong end of the stick. Which is fascinating, because one of the things that we do all the time is teach midrash after midrash after midrash to children, okay? If you want a nice light Dvar Torah for people who are not too, you know, too big a Talmid Chacham, you have a nice midrash, yeah? According to this, and you can see the sources yourself, this is actually the worst thing to do with midrash. Midrash is reserved for the Talmid Chachamim, because they really know what it means. For people who are going to misuse it, or laugh at it, or abuse it, and the Sefer Chassidim says, just like people will turn around and say the Midrash is silly, because they don't understand it, so they'll say, well, everything else is silly as well. Okay? Which is one of the reasons why I dislike strongly the Sheva Brochas, Gematria, Torah, you know, I put the name of the Chosan and the name of the Kala, and it comes up to this, that, and the other, you know, that's not my cup of tea. Okay, other people like that, whatever. But just be aware the Midrashim are, they have their kind of, dangerous side as well, and if you have to handle them with care. But what's the bottom line? Can you learn halacha from midrash? Yes or no? Maybe. Okay? And next time, next week, we're not here, but, well, I'm not here, but in this session, 2 weeks from now, we'll get into more Tu B'Shvat Torah.